talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gahan. Tonight's show is about genius and defiance as we explore how Oscar Wilde went from the heights of literary fame to the depths of public scandal as we debate his remarkable legacy. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Known for his sharp wit, flamboyant style and glittering conversation, Oscar Wilde was one of the most famous Irish personalities of the 19th century and one of the great writers of the Victorian era. He was also one of Trinity College Dublin's most celebrated alumni, and visitors to the Old Library at Trinity can now enjoy a carefully curated collection of rare Oscar Wilde archival material and memorabilia on display in the Long Room. The exhibition is entitled Oscar Wilde From Decadence to Despair. It runs until the 29th of January 2025, and access to it is included with a ticket to the Book of Kells experience. And you can also find an online version of the exhibition on the Trinity Library website. And so to discuss the rise and fall of Oscar Wilde, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Martin Burns is the creative director at Oscar Wilde House and collaborated on the Oscar Wilde Festival in Dublin, Oscariana. Professor Jarlath Killeen is the head of the School of English at Trinity College Dublin and is an expert on the literature and culture of Victorian Britain and Ireland. And his books include The Fates of Oscar Wilde and The Fairy Tales of Oscar Wilde. Well, you're both very welcome. And later in the show, I'll be talking to Caoimhe Ní Gormán, the manuscript's creator at Trinity College Dublin Library and the creator of this Oscar Wilde exhibition. Well, you're all very welcome to the show. And Martin, I might begin with you, and I might begin with Oscar Wilde today in the 21st century. Why does he still exert such a hold on the popular imagination? Why is there still such huge interest in his life, in his writings, in his downfall, in his story?
Well, I think that there's a few answers to that. One is, I suppose, the epigrams that he's known for, his sayings. They're very, you know, bite-sized in today's world. People, you don't have to be universally educated to know that, you know, some of his quotes, we're all in the gutter, some of his, you know, looking at the stars. There's also those iconic photographs from America in 1882 by Napoleon Cerroni. I think that they're probably the best images of Oscar that we have, and they're kind of iconic. And I think in general, he is adored because of the fact that his life was just so tragic, that he sleepwalked into tragedy. I think that we all see that kind of self-destruct thing in a lot of Irish artists. And I think that Oscar was kind of one of the great examples of that. You know, a lot of it had to do with pride before a fall.
It's very interesting what you said there about sleepwalking into tragedy. And that's really what happens, because I don't think people really understand how the downfall came about. It wasn't that a prosecution was initially brought against Wilde. It was Wilde brought that case against Queensberry.
Yeah, he was under pressure from his boyfriend, who was Lord Alfred Douglas. And Bosie Douglas was someone who, in today's parlance, you'd say had, I suppose, anger management issues. It doesn't sort of say very much about Oscar that that's the person he kind of throws his life away for. Anyway, the Marquess of Queensberry was Bosie Douglas's father, and he had three sons, and two of his sons were gay. And he's one of these men that thinks that his son's sexuality is some sort of reflection on his own masculinity, which is nonsense, as we know. But he had a fist fight with his other gay son, Francis, in the street, and they had two busted noses, and they were told to keep the peace by the Metropolitan Police. And then Oscar Wilde was running around with his other son, and Queensberry kind of flipped out. He went to Oscar's house and threatened him. And then he ramped up the campaign. He went to restaurants around London, warning off the maitre d's, managers of hotels at Oscar Wilde. And he said, if my son and Oscar Wilde stay here and I find out about it, I'm going to come back into town with a bullwhip, and I'm going to whip you within an inch of your life, he said to one guy. And Oscar Wilde's boyfriend was also a maniac. He was running around town with a gun. And the two of them were drinking heavily, and, you know, playing the game, chasing guys, drinking. The gun actually goes off in a restaurant by accident, and they're asked to leave. And Oscar is in the middle of a family feud, but he's so egotistical and drunk on his own sense of self, and drunk as well all the time. He was a heavy drinker. That he, that Queensbury decides that he's had enough of Wilde, and it all culminates with the premiere of The Importance of Being Earnest, which is February 1895. So Queensbury decides that he's going to attack the theatre with his heavies, and they're planning this, and it's overheard, and Bosie is informed of this, and Bosie tells Oscar. Oscar tells the cops, and the Metropolitan Police sort of guard St. James's Theatre, and Queensbury shows up anyway, and there's another scuffle. Queensbury showed up with a bouquet of rotten vegetables. We don't know what he was going to do with them, whether he was going to throw them at the actors or present them to Oscar in some sort of mock tribute. We don't know. Anyway, he goes away with a flea in his ear, and he goes to Oscar's club, and he leaves that infamous card. He wrote on it, to Oscar Wilde, posing sodomite. He actually wrote sodomite, but we know what he meant. And then Oscar comes back after a trip following the premiere of The Importance of Being Earnest, and he's handed the card. And, you know, really, he should have thrown that thing in a bin, but he shows it to his crazy boyfriend, and his crazy boyfriend wants to get his own back on his father, and he claims that his father's made a mistake, and that's a criminal libel, and he puts pressure on Oscar to prosecute the Marquess of Queensbury for this criminal libel. And Oscar at first is not interested. He says, well, I don't have any money for a prosecution anyway. He was terribly bad at money. He had three hit plays, the Lady Windermere's Fan, A Woman of No Importance, and An Ideal Husband. And despite the fact that these three things were running pretty much in the West End, he was £36 overdrawn at the bank. So Bosie keeps putting pressure on him, and Oscar's thinking about, you know, what to do. And part of the decision he makes to prosecute may have been because he was incredibly superstitious. So was his parents. I mean, his father was born in Roscommon in 1815, and his mother was born in Wexford in 1821. And those people grew up with believing in this otherworldliness that we do not believe today, the Celtic twilight world. W.B.H. was another person who believed in all this sort of stuff. And about a couple of years before he wrote Lady Windermere's Fan, Oscar had been to see a fortune teller, the Sybil of Mortimer Street, he called her, and she predicted that he would become really rich and famous because of something tangible. He was kind of famous already, but really famous for being famous. And then it happens. The Lady Windermere's Fan was an enormous success in today's money. It made about $1 million in the first year, and it all goes to Oscar's head. It's the worst thing that could have happened to him. So all the money comes rolling in. He kind of has a condition where he cannot hold on to money. He's a spendthrift. He's throwing money away around London like crazy. The cab drivers are beating each other to get at him because he's a great tipper. He's spending, we have the maths on this. He was spending about £2,000 per day in today's money. You can imagine you spent 2,000 euros today and same tomorrow. That's what he was doing. It's hard going. So he goes back to the fortune teller when he's thinking about what to do, and she predicts that success. So he goes to his lawyer, and his lawyer looks him in the eye and says, look, is there any truth in any of this? And Oscar lies through his teeth. We don't know why, but he lies through his teeth. And then Queensbury's arrested for the criminal libel and goes to court. And then famously he hires Edward Carson. You know,
and Edward Carson is another, you know, great Irishman, even if people may not agree with his later political stands. But people often blame Carson for the downfall of Wilde's, but Carson was just representing his client in the case.
Indeed, he was hired by Queensbury to defend him in Wilde's libel case. Carson actually went to the Attorney General after that failed prosecution and said, look, can we not just leave the guy alone now? And famously, the Attorney General says, I would, but we can't, which means the establishment.
And Oscar Wilde kind of self-destructed on the witness stand as well, that he could have answered the questions differently, but he seemed almost to court the controversy and to court his own downfall and the way he arrogantly answered some of the questions.
Yeah, I mean, the first question he was asked was, I see here, Mr. Wilde, you're 39 years old. Well, that's correct. Well, you're not. I know you. I mean, Carson and Wilde went to college together. They knew each other. and he knew that he was 40. So the first question, he was exposed as a liar. And then it's almost as if Oscar was on trial for daring to cross the class barrier. Kept going on about, you were with this young man, you bought him a champagne lunch. This other guy, you brought him to Brighton, you bought him a suit, bought him champagne. And he says to Oscar, it's always champagne with you, isn't it? And Oscar says, yes, I drink too much champagne, contrary to my doctor's orders. Carson says, never mind your doctor's orders. And Oscar says, I never do. Big laugh from the public gallery. And then on the back of that, he keeps going on about this young man. Did you kiss that young man? And because Oscar has just got a laugh, he goes, no, he was much too ugly. And Carson has him then. He's on the back foot and he keeps pushing this point. Why did you say it was ugly? Why did you say it was ugly? Carson in Queensbury had hired a private detective, and it took the private detective about, I don't know, 45 seconds to find out what was going on with Oscar and Bosie around town. So all these guys are in court, paid off and ready to give evidence. Oscar's brief looks at what's going down and says, look, we need to drop this case immediately and pray. So Queensbury walks out of the Old Bailey. There's cheering from the crowds, homophobic chants. And then the British government have a big problem. What did they do with Oscar Wilde? There's allegations of gross indecency have just come out in court. So they're duty-bound to prosecute. They kind of don't want to, because Oscar Wilde's boyfriend, Bosie, his brother Francis, he's rumoured to be having an affair with Rosebery, who was the Minister for Foreign Affairs, who actually went on to be Prime Minister of England. So Oscar was a threat to the establishment. So they issue an arrest warrant, but they give him kind of 7 hours to get out of Dodge. And instead of going to the coast and taking a boat to France, as they wanted him to do, he instead goes to the Cadogan Hotel in Chelsea and starts drinking white wine spritzers for 7 hours until the cops come. And then they show up and he's arrested. And then, of course, that goes to trial. There's two trials. And he is eventually found guilty and sentenced to 2 years hard labour.
And Charlotte, it is a very difficult 2 years. He's in various prisons, eventually ending up in Reading Jail. And of course, there's this famous ballad of Reading Jail. And it really is the end of that kind of glorious era of Oscar Wilde, the celebrity. It's much harder and darker from that point on.
Once he comes out, so he's already written his great prison letter, which eventually is published as De Profundis. And he writes, or finishes at least, The Ballad of Reading Jail. And he writes a couple of public letters protesting about the treatment of prisoners. And that's really it in terms of his literary life after he leaves. There are various plans made, various schemes that he certainly needs money, but he never manages to kind of push himself forward and kind of recover his either his kind of ambition or his enthusiasm for writing. And one issue could be the amount of alcohol being consumed, the amount of absence. He may be characterized as drunk for the last couple of years of his life. And he was ill for that reason. But certainly that's he seems to enjoy himself. I shouldn't overstress how tragic it is. Some recent critics who looked at the last couple of years of his life have emphasized how much fun he's having, and he's traveling around Europe and he's meeting interesting people, but his literary life has come to an end essentially.
And Charlotte, I find it very hard to separate his life, because it is so dramatic and it is so colourful. There are all those epigrams that Martin has talked about. He is a gay icon. He is a celebrity. It's hard to separate that from his works, from the output. And I wonder, does that influence how we still evaluate those works?
I think one thing we need to remember is that in the trial, the original trial, Queensbury trial, the picture of Dorian Gray is essentially evidence for the defence. Carson interrogates him about the picture of Dorian Gray. So Dorian Gray is one of the major moments of cross-examination between them. And so he's quizzing him about the way Dorian Gray is presented, what are the sins of Dorian Gray in that novel, what's the issue of influence of an older man on a younger man. And so Wilde is being quizzed and interrogated and cross-examined about his literary text and also about his epigrams, because he published two articles in a newspaper, which are just two collections of epigrams. He's also been quizzed about these. So his novel and his epigrams are part of the evidence used against him. So that does link his life and his work and particular parts of his work very closely together. And it bound up in his fall, I suppose, in that sense.
And you're an expert on Victorian literature and culture. How great a writer is Oscar Wilde? If we were to separate the works from his life story, mm-hmm. you know, would we still consider Dorian Gray, The Importance of Being Earnest, The Ballad of Reading Gaol, the, you know, some of the plays, would we still consider them great works of Victorian literature? Or is it, again, still so closely connected with his life?
I think yes, he would be now considered a major writer. I think what happened is that his life overshadowed his work. So in the first, you know, 40 or 50 years after his death, his life was what people were interested in. And of course, his life kind of, because of his imprisonment, that kind of made his works omerta to a certain extent. You didn't talk about Oscar Wilde very much. You certainly didn't study his work in universities. But in the last, say, 40 years or so, there's been a renewed focus on him as a thinker. So his great essays, The Decay of Lying, for example, his novel as a major, you know, the only novel he wrote, The Picture of Dorian Gray, as one of the major texts of the 1890s. And also, so he's also extremely eclectic. So he writes fairy tales, he writes poetry, he writes long philosophical essays, he writes a novel, and he writes these great plays, one of which, The Importance of Being Earnest, may well be the greatest comedy ever written. So that alone would have kind of ensured his reputation. Because even when nobody could speak his name, people were still putting on productions of The Importance of Being Earnest.
Martin, can I ask you about his parents, Sir William Wilde and Lady Jane Wilde? Because they were both, you know, incredible figures in their own right. They had very distinguished careers. His mother, as Speranza, was a distinguished writer as well. How influential were they in terms of his development? And I suppose, how significant are they in terms of understanding his story?
Well, they're extremely important on how Oscar develops, particularly the household itself. Number one, Merrion Square, is where they lived from 1855 to 1879. And Oscar's mother was part of the Young Ireland movement in the 1840s during the famine. And she famously becomes a hero to the Irish nation after she pretty much calls for an armed rising in a newspaper. And the British authorities wanted to know who the Speranza was. And when they found that it was a woman, they dropped the case because I think the Attorney General said at the time it would be like putting your daughter or your niece in the dock, and obviously this woman has been hanging around with men who filled her head full of all this nonsense. They thought that women were incapable of coming up with a political opinion of their own. And Jane Wilde was a force of nature. She was a translator, very competent translator. She could speak multiple languages. She was kind of a proto-feminist, and she held these great salons in the house in Merrion Square. So anybody who came to Dublin invariably ended up in that house. Clara Schumann, the composer, she played a concert here and was brought along to that house. The Emperor of Mexico went there. Any writers or politicians traveling through Dublin ended up there. And it was salons. So it was debates and it was recitations, French and English. It was music. It was conversation. A lot of the talk was during the American Civil War. This is when they lived there. So that was a big topic of conversation in the house. And they instilled in Oscar his values. His mother said that we are above respectability in this house. His father famously said, the rules don't apply to great men. So they you know, brought him up in a particular culture. His father was another very interesting man. He was a polymath. He was an eye and ear surgeon. He was an archaeologist. He was a statistician, a topographer, a travel writer. And he got himself into a lot of trouble with women. He had at least three, we don't use this term today, but illegitimate children that Speranza knew about when they got married. He had a 14-year-old son called Henry Wilson and two infant daughters, Emily and Mary, when they wed. And she took him on board because women were second-class citizens back then. You know, you couldn't go to university, you couldn't vote, you couldn't even speak about politics in a room. It was not expected of you. So she marries this man who was up to her intellectual standards, one of the few men around town. And then they move into Westland Row. Willie Jr. is born first, and then Oscar is born in 1854. But when Jane was 6 months pregnant with Oscar, her husband, William Wilde, treats this young girl called Mary Travers, who's 19 years old, and he takes a fancy to her and he kind of goes after her. He goes to her father and asked for permission for his daughter to help William Wilde with some research. And of course, this research turns into an affair, and that affair went on for, you know, almost a decade. And Spranger knew all about it. So this is the culture in which Oscar grew up. It's a house full of dignitaries, celebrities from America and beyond. The father is having an affair. He's famously also someone who suffers from perhaps you would say depression. When he wasn't active in his mind, he was in the depths of despair. And there's a famous letter where Speranza says, "My husband, so brilliant to the world, sits in his library surrounded in a black pall." And then the next thing, he's inspired by something, and off he goes. You know, if his mind wasn't active, he was in the depths of despair. And he fought this depression with two things. That's an amazing work ethic and a nonstop pursuit of women. So this is the culture in which Oscar grew up. And there's a lot of booze going on in that house as well. Boozy nights, boozy parties. So it's not really a wonder that both Oscar and his brother have a liking for alcohol as they get older as well.
Charlotte, how should we understand the time that Oscar Wilde spent in Trinity? Because he didn't graduate, he ended up skipping off to Oxford. But yet, you know, we both work in Trinity. Trinity loves the Oscar Wilde connection. He is an alumnus, even if he's not a graduate. And there is that wonderful exhibition taking place now in the Long Room. So for Trinity, it's certainly a strong connection, but was it as important and significant for Oscar Wilde himself?
I think it was important for a number of reasons. One is that he becomes friends with John Petlin Mahaffey, who becomes a kind of mentor to him. And he begins to work with Mahaffey on the construction of particular texts. So he helps Mahaffey in his research and stays with Mahaffey in Howth one summer, helping him research and write a book. So that's really important. And Mahaffey is a raconteur. Mahaffey is a socialite, just like his parents. So he would have got that. So that's really significant for him. He also develops a kind of work ethic himself. It's clear that he worked hard while pretending not to. So he's a scholar. He comes first, I think, in foundation scholarship in his second year. And is clearly acing his way through college and comes out eventually with a double first from Oxford. But he adopts this persona where he's very relaxed and, you know, can speed read through material. So he does adopt this kind of aesthetic persona. And I think he starts to develop that at Trinity.
And is it true that Mahaffey reappears then in some of his works, that he uses the inspiration of Mahaffey for some of his characters?
Well, one of the kind of cottage industries in Oscar Wilde studies is like tracing various characters, particularly the characters in the picture of Dorian Gray, back to real life examples. And as sort of dozens of people seem to go into the creation of these characters. So I would be a bit skeptical, but what he does, he writes to Mahaffey, quite late in his career and says, "You were my first and best mentor." So he holds that affection for him all the way through. Not so Mahaffey, of course, who once the Wilde was imprisoned, wanted to forget all about him and didn't want to be associated with him at all. But it was quite important for Wilde. Wilde was, when he was here, he was Speranza's son, because Speranza was Speranza of the nation. And when he got the double first in Oxford, the newspapers all proclaimed this. In practically every newspaper in Dublin announced his success. But they all said, Speranza's son has achieved this. This is a great achievement for the nation of Ireland. And he was expected to go on to a public career here, but because she was such a public figure.
Martin, the exhibition includes some wonderful materials from the famous tour of the United States in 1882. And of course, people can see it in person, or there's the online version as well. And I'm just wondering, how significant was that journey, that tour, in terms of developing, I suppose, the reputation, but also some of the mythology around Oscar Wilde?
Yeah, the America tour is very important. He went there when he was 27. He was asked by Doyle Cart, who was the producer of the Gilbert and Sullivan operettas, to go over there and give a series of lectures in his aesthetic outfit so that the Americans could look at his clothes and have a laugh, because the aesthetic movement hadn't really made it to the US and Canada. So, and then this thing kind of turns into a phenomenon. He ends up going to Canada, up to Montreal, then he's over to San Francisco, the Bay Area, and then back through Salt Lake City, Denver, Colorado, And then he goes to the South. So it's 17 years after the end of the American Civil War. The South is rebuilding, and he goes down. He goes to Texas. He goes to Alabama, Georgia.
He meets Jefferson Davis at one point.
Jefferson Davis, yeah. And famously gets into trouble with Jefferson Davis because he got his nieces drunk, and Jefferson Davis had enough of him, went off to bed early. But he made up for meeting Jefferson Davis by meeting Ulysses S. Grant when he was in New Jersey later on in the tour. So he was fated by a lot of... He got a lot of trouble there from the press. It was a kind of a love-hate relationship. They made fun of him. There's some quite horrendous cartoons of him and some real racist cartoons involving aesthetic movement, some of which are... some of the other cards are available to see at the exhibition at Trinity. But he did 141 talks in 11 months across the US and Canada, which is a phenomenal amount of traveling. If you look at the map of this journey, you wonder how he did it, because it's so the distances are enormous. So he's traveling. He goes back to Canada towards the end of the tour, and this time he does the Maritime region, you know, Halifax, Nova Scotia, etc. And then done, and everybody in Dublin and in Paris and in London were reading about Wilde's American tour in awe. They thought he was making a fortune, and he was making a fortune, but it's Oscar Wilde we're talking about, so he couldn't get rid of the money quick enough. Actually, when he stops the tour in November 1882, he kind of goes on a casino, cab and restaurant bender around New York, and his mother's writing to him saying, pay your debts in England, and marry a millionaire while you're over there. You know, she wanted him to marry the daughter of a, I don't know, Kansas City beef baron or a New York City stockbroker.
But Martin, what I don't understand is this is before the publication or the performance of the great plays, before the publication of the great novel, Portrait of Dorian Gray. He's not this established writer, playwright. So why are they so interested in hearing what this man called Oscar Wilde has to say?
Well, they're interested in him because D'Oyly Carte was interested in him because he was at kind of at the vanguard of this new thing called the aesthetic movement. Basically, in 1861, Queen Victoria's husband died, and she was famously miserable, and she wanted everybody else to be miserable as well. So the British authorities wanted to kind of cultivate this culture of stiff upper lip, empire building, you know, serious sort of Protestantism, and a whole generation of young men and women in England rebelled against that kind of stifled ideology. They said, we're going to enjoy life. You know, they worship sunflowers and lilies and poetry. And the establishment hate this thing. And of course, when the establishment hate anything, the bigger it gets. So aesthetic movement becomes mainstream. And Oscar Wilde is never out of the newspapers because he befriends Lily Langtry, who is who's having an affair with the Prince of Wales. So they're always in the paper. They're always, the opening of the Grosvenor Gallery or wherever Lily and Langtry at the opening night of a new play, they're celebrities. So Oscar is famous for being famous, and he's at the vanguard of the aesthetic movement, which is in vogue at the time. So that's why D'Oyly Carte came to him and said, look, will you go over to America and publicize our new play, which was a parody of the aesthetic movement.
And he has all the great lines, like, I have nothing to declare except my genius.
Yeah,
and
that didn't really come out until 1910.
Okay.
We don't know whether or not he said that. It's disputed. What he did say, though, when he was when he arrived in New York, the reporter said to him, "How was the crossing?" And he says, "I was terribly disappointed with the Atlantic." And they love this. This goes straight into the newspaper, and they realize that this guy is going to be good for a quote. Who better for a quote than Oscar Wilde? And he realizes that the newspapers are going to be good for selling tickets to his lecture tour.
Jarlath, how much was known about his sexuality in his lifetime? Because he did marry a woman, Constance, in 1884, and I suppose there wasn't as clear an understanding about, you know, homosexuality wouldn't have been open in those times. So would people have looked at him and said, oh, I wonder, is he a gay man? Or would they just have said, no, he's just a flamboyant, dramatic character?
They certainly wouldn't have looked at him and thought, is that a gay man? Because I suppose one thing, they wouldn't have had that kind of vocabulary. They wouldn't have had that kind of terminology. And some of the anxieties around him, and if you look at some of the caricatures, the representation of an aesthetic man was that he would steal your wife because he would understand her better than you would. And there's all these kind of caricatures in newspapers showing the aesthetic or the aesthete staying at home, talking to the wife while the husband has gone into the drawing room smoking. So there was a sense in which there was certainly kind of a sexual frisson about the estate, but it wasn't all that clear exactly what that sexual frisson meant. I remember as well that Wilde, as well as marrying a woman, he had also been engaged prior to his marriage to Constance to the woman that would eventually go on to marry Bram Stoker. So while he was in Dublin, he became secretly engaged essentially to Florence Balcombe, one of the most beautiful women of the period. So I don't think it was all that clear in public. And remember when Queensberry leaves that card in the hotel, he writes posing as a sodomite. The accusation there was not that Wilde was a sodomite, but that he was posing as one, and he was kind of playing it and performing it. So I think it was certainly clear to a circle, a group, and maybe among certain groups of people, the dogs on the street might have known then. But Wilde's wife certainly didn't know, and she was shocked when this emerged. And other, you know, and other groups of his friends were surprised when this emerged, including some of his male friends, but among an inner circle, it was widely known.
And is the age gap a problem in terms of, you know, the 16-year age gap between Wilde and Bosie and the age gap between Wilde and some of these sexual relationships? That is that something that's just, you know, normal for the time or usual for the time, or something that, you know, gives us pause for thought and reflection now?
I think it's an anxiety when people look at it. I mean, part of it is taken from this kind of idea of a Greek relationship, the mentor and the mentee, and Wilde becoming the mentor at that stage as an older man, and being a mentor to undergraduate students, or in some cases with the male sex workers, they're very young. They're often 16-year-olds and slightly older. But he sees it as this Greek model, and he speaks about it in the second trial. He gives a long speech on what he calls the love that dare not speak his name, which he takes from one of Bosie's poems. He talks about it as this intellectual friendship that first theorized in Plato's Symposium. So he kind of aestheticizes and intellectualizes it. He doesn't dwell in that theorizing on the sexual aspect. But of course, in Plato's theory, sexuality is central to it.
But if these were relationships with young women or with girls, you know, we might possibly be cancelling Oscar Wilde, or certainly being much more critical of him. But, you know, there does seem to be a kind of a complication, because there's same-sex relationships that, you know, we try to be a more tolerant and understanding society now, but at the same time there are elements that are problematic. So it is something that perhaps we are maybe a little inconsistent in.
Well, certainly with some of the male sex workers, they're not just younger, but they're also of a different class. They're of a lower class. They're working class boys. So I think there's also that anxiety. So in one sense, Wilde is slumming it, and that's the language used at the time about these kind of cross-class relationships. His father, who was involved with this 19-year-old patient of his, that's almost radioactive now to speak about, and certainly Sir William Wilde would be cancelled, I think, now without a doubt. There would be no, he's probably, I was talking to Martin before the program, would his knighthood be withdrawn at this, you know, if this came out now? But I think there is the issue there that Wilde's relationship with these boys, because it was underground, because it was so, it wasn't legal. I think we need to look at it in that kind of sense. How else would these relationships develop?
And it is extraordinary, Martin, the way Wilde's story and the tragedy, it opens up so many different parts of Victorian Britain and Ireland to us, about sexuality, about literature, about, I suppose, the culture of celebrity, that we do get an insight and an understanding of so many different hidden aspects of a changing world at that time.
Yeah, I mean, Oscar, as well as using sex workers, Oscar formed a bunch of relationships with young men who idolized him. He was the main figure in the fin de siècle decadent movement, and he was a player. He started relationships with young men and left a lot of broken hearts around London. And this is the part that Oscar Wilde fans who come to Oscar Wilde House are very uncomfortable with, because we do not paint him as Saint Oscar. We tell the truth, and the truth is way more interesting. And the truth is that when he, you know, embarks on his new life, when he's liberated after his, you know, he starts having relationships with men, he's horrible to his wife. I mean, really horrible. There's some letters when he talks about her body in the most grotesque terms. He describes his wife's body after the birth of a second child, describing her walking around the house like a wounded animal, and that her body and her breasts kind of sickened and repulsed them. It's a horrible thing to say about a woman who's given you two children. And then he, you know, he ramps up the this condition he has with money, that in conjunction with that, he's running around town blowing enormous amounts of money. And remember, Speranza is living in Chelsea, a half a mile away, and she's kind of broke. She's living with her other son, Willie, who's in the depths of alcoholism. And Oscar, she writes to Oscar at one point and says, Oscar, can I borrow £20 of you? And he kind of sends her 40. And another time she has to borrow money off her housekeeper, and he sends her another 40. But he's only putting out fires. He could have bought his mother a house. He could have bought his mother two houses. But he was just incapable of prudence with money. He's running around crazy and spending enormous amounts. And he moves Bosie Douglas in the midst of all this. He moves Bosie Douglas into a hotel in London for 3 months because he wanted to impress Lord Alfred Douglas. And on room service alone in that 3 month period, we have the bill. And in today's money, Oscar Wilde spent £180,000 on room service. I mean, that's obscene for all sorts of reasons. His wife's at home with two kids wondering where the hell he is. His mum's broke, and Oscar's running around with this young aristocrat. And one of the attractions to Lord Alfred Douglas was that he was a lord, and Oscar was a total snob. He was a social climber, and that had a lot to do with his attraction towards him. So he is a very problematic character. You both love him and loathe him. And the more you find out about all of the Wilde family, actually, I was saying this to Jarth at the start, the more you kind of dislike them. You kind of love them and you dislike them. I mean, they are a difficult subject, but they're kind of, the Wilde house is kind of like a petri dish of human nature. It's just, you know, the people put themselves out there for you know, their own pleasure, and they will put themselves at risk to acquire this pleasure.
And Martin, I'm very struck by what you said there, that, you know, he's not Saint Oscar. And is that the problem, that we tend to idealise Oscar Wilde? We tend to, you know, buy into the mythology, and we simplify the story, and we just see him as this ideal dinner party guest, but we don't want to engage with any of the more difficult aspects of his life or his personality, and that's kind of doing an injustice to his life as well.
Well, there is part of that, but people don't know the details of his life. And very often after we do the guided tour at Oscar Wilde House, people come up and say, I don't know if I like Oscar Wilde anymore. And that's the truth. And I say, well, look, there's no point in disliking him because, you know, he's long dead. And there's no point in trying to, cancel him. He went to prison, and the prison pretty much killed him. So what more do you want? So he is an infuriating person.
I think that's the key, that he went to prison and was punished, and he became a kind of martyr. And then he's a very useful figure then in terms of the emerging gay movement as a major literary figure who was imprisoned for his sexuality. And that is partly where the sainthood, the kind of Saint Oscar idea comes from. And because he is very important in that kind of, in providing leverage at that stage.
And Martin, the website for Oscar Wilde House, it's oscarwildhouse.com, and you can book the tours there. But it sounds brilliant the way you kind of, it's, I think, something that Oscar Wilde himself would have enjoyed, the fact that people go perhaps expecting to hear this saintly version of the life, and instead the whole story is subverted from the inside out. Well, we'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be exploring that new exhibition in Trinity College Dublin, Oscar Wilde, From Decadence to Despair. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history. Tonight we are continuing our exploration on the rise and indeed the fall of Oscar Wilde, and I'm delighted to be joined by Caoimhe Ní Gormáin, who's the manuscripts curator at the Trinity College Dublin Library, and she curated that wonderful new exhibition, Oscar Wilde, From Decadence to Despair, that is running until the 29th of January 2025, and there is an online version of the exhibition also available for viewing on the Trinity College Dublin Library website. Caoimhe, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Patrick.
So tell me me about the exhibition and how it was put together and the wonderful items that are in it.
So it really maps out the rise and fall of Oscar Wilde, and we decided to put the exhibition together. It's a rerun, so we had it out in 2017. It was the first major exhibition on Oscar Wilde. And in 2017, we had Rupert Everett over to launch the exhibition. So it was really very, very successful. And we decided to run it again. And we really wanted to celebrate Wilde as a Dublin boy, as a Trinity boy. I think often he is overlooked, his early life in Dublin, because he's very often associated with his later years as a student in Oxford, and is often considered a British person, even though he is a huge, in fact, Irish personality.
And very few Irish institutions have materials or have an Oscar Wilde archive. This is kind of pretty much the only one.
That's correct. This is the only Oscar Wilde archive held in a public institution in Ireland. And the exhibition was indeed the first exhibition, major exhibition of Oscar Wilde material ever held in Ireland.
So what insights do we get into Oscar Wilde from the items that you have?
So they really mark his early years in Dublin, his days as a student in Trinity College, his later life. He went on a lecture tour of the United States in 1882, and that really kind of catapulted him into fame, so to speak. He hadn't really published anything at that point, but he went on a tour of self-promotion. So we have some lovely material relating to that time. We have a set of beautifully illustrated commercial trade cards inspired by his famous aesthetic tour. So his face at the end of that year was used to advertise a wide variety of products, from stoves to matches to face creams. Such was his popularity at the end of that time. There is quite a focus on in the collection in his exile years. So the time, quite the sad few years when he had served his prison sentence in Reading Jail. He was convicted of gross indecency and he served 2 years hard labour in Reading Jail. And what we refer to, I suppose, as his downfall, his years in exile, were the 3 very sad years following that time. So he came out of jail destitute and penniless, and he changed his name to Sebastian Melmoth because he couldn't be known as Oscar Wilde anymore. And he spent his years in exile. He went to France, he went to Italy, he travelled around Europe. He had relatively no money. He relied on the charity of friends during that time. And then he died in a hotel in Paris in 1900. And he was just 54 when he died.
You also have the original theatre programme from the opening night of The Importance of Being Earnest in 1895. And that was a particularly significant night for Wilde, because it was also the night he was arrested. So it was a moment of great triumph for him in terms of the success of the play.
Yeah.
And also then in terms of the tragedy and the approaching crisis.
Yes, and that really was the pinnacle of his career. The Importance of Being Earnest was his most successful play. It was his last play. And yes, he was arrested on that night. So we have the theatre programme on display in the Long Room from the opening night of The Importance of Being Earnest. He was in a relationship with Lord Alfred Douglas. Oscar Wilde was still married at the time. And of course, homosexuality was considered a crime at that time also.
How has the public reacted, or how has the public responded to seeing these personal items to do with Oscar Wilde, to do with the tour of America and the programme notes, and to I suppose, follow in the footsteps of Wilde going through the Trinity Library where he would have studied and so on?
Oscar Wilde, we know him obviously as the great literary great, a huge Irish personality, but there's something else about him that still resonates with people. I think it's the story of his life. I think it is the personality. I think Oscar Wilde, the icon, the glamour and intrigue sort of surrounding his life, that still resonates with people today. And for me, he was a person who wasn't afraid to be himself, who wasn't afraid to wear these flamboyant outfits and to have affairs with men. And there's a quote, obviously he was the master of the one-liner, but the quote that always sticks in my mind is, be yourself, everyone else is taken.
Excellent. And Caoimhe, I also think it's brilliant that our listeners will be able to explore the exhibition online by going to the virtual Trinity Library, because you have some of the collection digitised, and the fact that people can go in person, they can look at these items, these artefacts, these wonderful items from the career of Oscar Wilde, but they can also do it from the comfort of their own homes.
Absolutely. So while the physical exhibition is in the Long Room and we've over 22 exhibits there, obviously, I would highly recommend you come and visit it in person, but if for some reason you can't, the whole collection has been fully digitised. There's an online exhibition curated with over 100 items available to see there, so you can have a much deeper exploration. You can read letters, you can zoom in, so often it's much easier. You can do it at your leisure, you can take your time. It's a highly visual exhibition. It's a collection that lends itself very well to exhibition. It's not a typical literary archive collection. It's a collector's collection. So there are lots of letters, photographs, memorabilia, colourful items. So it really is, it is something special and unique.
It is indeed something special and unique. Well, the wonderful exhibition Oscar Wilde From Decadence to Despair, running until the 29th of January 2025 in the Long Room in Trinity. But of course, there is that online version of the exhibition as well that you can access on the virtual Trinity Library. My thanks to Caoimhe Ní Gormán, the manuscripts curator at Trinity College Dublin and the curator of that wonderful exhibition. Caoimhe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be rejoining our panel to continue our exploration of the rise and fall of Oscar Wilde right after this. Well, welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the rise and fall of Oscar Wilde. I'm rejoined by Martin Burns, the creative director at Oscar Wilde House. A brilliant tour there. Just go to their website, oscarwildehouse.com. And I'm also rejoined by Professor Jarlath Killeen, the head of the School of English at Trinity College Dublin and an expert on the literature and culture of Victorian Britain and Ireland. Jarlath, let's try and sum up the legacy then of Oscar Wilde. How do you think he should be remembered in the 21st century?
I think it is important to remember him as a celebrity figure. He is, that's how he becomes famous first. He's famous for being famous, as Martin was saying. And I think that's really important for understanding how significant he becomes for people like glam rock, like Bowie, see him in that sense. He's important as a writer in terms of he writes some of the most significant texts of the period. He writes the best comedy ever written. So that's the kind of Oscar Wilde I would want to remember. In terms of his Irish connections, I'd like to bring the fairy tales back into consideration as a major contribution to the literature of childhood. So those are the kind of legacies I think that's important.
Brilliant. And Martin, what about you? What do you think is the great legacy of Oscar Wilde?
I would say the great legacy is just an iconic figure. But his legacy, I think, is of a great intellect, of a great Irish writer, and someone who is an infuriating and lovable person at the same time.
So, Martin, when he died then, where was Wilde buried?
Well, he died in Paris on the 30th of November 1900, and he was buried, first of all, in a cemetery to the south of Paris, and then Robbie Ross, the executor of his estate, he organised a tomb in Père Lachaise, and that tomb was designed by the American sculptor Jacob Epstein. And when that tomb was unveiled in the cemetery, this is very Oscar Wilde, it was banned by the French authorities because they did not like the penis on the genitalia on the sculpture that Epstein put there. And the French authorities put a tarpaulin over it and put a gendarme to guard the public from looking at it. And then there was a big debate in the newspapers whether or not this was a moral or an immoral tomb. And in the end, the First World War breaks out, and then the French have a bigger problem than a pair of limestone testicles on a tomb. So Wilde's tomb is the most visited tomb in Père Lachaise in Paris. That's part of Wilde's story, is the fact that even in death he was a divisive character.
Well, I think that's a brilliant note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to Martin Burns, the creative director at Oscar Wilde House. Wonderful tour there, and you can go to their website for more details or to book that. Professor Jarlath Killeen, the head of the School of English at Trinity College Dublin. And we were also joined earlier by Caoimhe Ní Gormán, the manuscripts curator at the Trinity College Dublin Library and involved in that wonderful new exhibition, Oscar Wilde From Decadence to Despair. And it's running until the end of January 2025, and an online version of the exhibition exhibition is also available for viewing free of charge on the Trinity Library website. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so I hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.